Hey everybody, it's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. Oh, welcome. Welcome to podcast number 3 of Indirect Democracy, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. My name is David, I'm your host. This week we're going to be having an update about global warming, taking a look at some little news tidbits, but mostly we're going to be looking at the hunt for bin Laden this week. As we all know, this was the 5th year anniversary of that horrible, horrible day. Just one of those days that will live in all of our hearts and souls and pass on to our kids, just trying to share the memories and personal experiences of what was a day that galvanized most of us, but at the same time led to some of the most divisiveness that I think we've ever seen in our country. Wow. Already starting to bum myself out, but welcome. Welcome to podcast number 3. My name is David. I am your host, and I'm really glad you could join me this week. Let's see. As I mentioned, we will be talking about global warming. It's going to try to be a constant topic in some way, shape, or form on this show to try to find new news stories out there. And this one came across. It was from AOL.com. And this one is entitled, Methane Escaping from Permafrost 5 times Faster Than Thought. Now, as it discussed in the very first podcast about global warming, I mentioned the fact that permafrost is starting to melt up in the land around the Arctic Circle. Now, this is Washington, September 7th, and I quote, global warming gases trapped in the soil are bubbling out of the thawing permafrost in amounts far higher than previously thought, and may trigger what researchers warn is a climate time bomb. The effects can be huge, said lead author Katie Walter of the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. It's coming out a lot, and there's a lot more to come out. That's astute. Let's see. Scientists worry about a global warming vicious cycle that was not part of their already gloomy climate forecast. Warming already underway thaws permafrost, soil that has been continuously frozen for thousands of years. Thawed permafrost releases methane and carbon dioxide. Those gases reach the atmosphere and help trap heat on Earth in the greenhouse effect. Okay. Most of the methane releasing permafrost is in Siberia. Another study earlier this summer in the Journal of Science found that the amount of carbon trapped in this type of permafrost, called Yadoma, is much more prevalent than originally thought and may be 100 times the amount of carbon released into the air each year by the burning of fossil fuels. It won't come out all at once or even over several decades, but if temperatures increase, then the methane and carbon dioxide will escape the soil, scientists say. The permafrost issue has caused quite a buzz of concern among climate scientists and geologists. Specialists in Arctic climate are coming up with research plans to study the permafrost effect, which is not well understood or observed. It's kind of like a slow-motion time bomb, said Ted Schur, a professor of ecosystem ecology at the University of Florida and co-author of the study in Science. Let's see, here's another quote. I don't think it can be easily stopped. We'd have to have major cooling for it to stop. Scientists aren't quite sure whether methane or carbon dioxide is worse. Methane is far more powerful in trapping heat, but only lasts about a decade before it dissipates into carbon dioxide and other chemicals. Carbon dioxide traps heat for about a century. So, as I have mentioned before, this is all gloomy stuff, and I understand that. But it's important stuff to discuss because climate change is a huge issue. It's still something we should always think about. And like I said, not meaning to guilt you into anything, but the little things we can do here and there. No, you can't walk up there and try to refreeze the permafrost, but if we can try to reduce our carbon footprint in little ways, we can helpfully change the overall effect. Now, if you want to get an idea of your own personal carbon footprint, I encourage you to go to the main homepage for Indirect Democracy, and you'll see a little tab there in the favorite link section called Calculate Your Impact. It'll take you to a site where you can see how much pounds per year you're putting out there of carbon dioxide. Measured my own recently, it was about 35,000 pounds. And if that doesn't shock you into changing your lifestyle, and I already take the bus and, you know, the train to get to work and trying to do everything I can, I'm a big fan of the bus myself anyway. It's or trying to take as much public transportation as possible, because only on the bus can you ever be on there and, you know, hear the bus driver really just narrate the effect of a car accident she's not involved in. And it went a little bit something like this. Ooh! Oh! Oh! Oh, you know that hurt. Oh, they better call somebody. First Street! So, that's just a little bit of an experience I have to go through in my morning. Let's see, talking about other news, this is from CNN.com. The report here is that 1 in 5 children will be obese. Let's see, according to the article from CNN.com, 1 in 5 children is predicted to be obese by the end of the decade. And in related news, McDonald's posts another strong month. August comparable sales were up 6%. So, there you go. Our kids deserve a break today. Now, in one more last piece of news, I think we'll skip this little news story for just a second, because it is time for the presidential horoscope. Now, as we have discussed before, our president is in fact a Cancer. So, from the pages of Elle magazine comes President George W. Bush's horoscope for this week. Let's see, his career meter reading is an 8. For September 11th through the 17th, you're looking for stability in your career sector. So people that you've known for years are the ones you surround yourself with. Why is it every time I read this, I'm actually starting to think it's eerily true for this man? Some may suggest that you branch out on your own and leave the past behind. But in your case, the past may be very instructive, a kind of foreshadowing of future talents and endeavors. Listen to the stories that friends and colleagues tell this week. Each conversation has seeds of promising ideas and potential for the future. Even if you're not officially working on Friday evening or early Saturday, your imagination is working overtime, conjuring up wonderful ideas for future projects. This week's touchstones are smoky quartz and, I guess it's Petersite? I've never touched that stone, and I'm not exactly sure if he's ever going to touch it either. But there you go. This is a fascinating little tidbit of a story that just came down from The Wire. If you are listening to the news as much as I do, it won't be news to you, but it's still fascinating. See, the president has been making efforts to try to create new laws to the Congress to deal with the way that we're going to try the people that we have captured at Guantanamo Bay using military tribunals. This has been met with opposition, including by 4 major Republicans, including John McCain. And recently, they received some support in the form of Colin Powell, our former Secretary of State. And this is from CNN.com, and it says, Powell joins opponents of Bush tribunal plan. And I want to make sure I can find the exact best part of this story. Or maybe it's just better to read the letter from General Powell. In his letter dated September 13th, Dear Senator McCain, I just returned to town and learned about the debate taking place in Congress to redefine Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. I do not support such a step and believe it would be inconsistent with the McCain Amendment on torture, which I supported last year. I have read the powerful and eloquent letter sent to you by one of my distinguished predecessors as Joint Chairman of the Chief of Staffs, General Jack Vesey. I fully endorse in torn and tint his powerful argument. The world is beginning to doubt, I apologize, the moral basis of our fight against terrorism. To redefine Common Article 3 would add to those doubts. Furthermore, it would put our own troops at risk. I am familiar with the Armed Forces officer, as is Jack Vesey. It was written after all the horrors, World War II and General George C. Marshall, then Secretary of Defense, I just can't talk, used it to tell the world and to remind our soldiers of our moral obligations with respect to those in custody. And those are the words of Colin Powell. Which, of course, gets us thinking about what began this entire war on terrorism, and which, of course, was the horrible events of 9/11, and the man and group which are at fault Fault seems like a very poor choice of words, but it all boils down to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Now, this week we remembered the events and the victims of September 11, 2001. We saw it by way of speeches, public and private ceremonies, documentaries, and even a movie of the week. And I didn't see that movie. I saw like maybe about an hour of it. And, you know, I could probably spend time going over it, but I think we all have our opinions as to that movie, and maybe one day I'll go over it in further detail, but not right now. I was thinking since that day 5 years ago, where do we stand? In 2001, and this is from a Rolling Stone article called Why Bush Fumbled the War on Terror. In 2001, during the Battle of Afghanistan, and this is also, to be honest, we have to really look at this and it's like give credit where credit is due. Our military and intelligence forces estimated that Al-Qaeda was about 5,000 strong. After this initial battle, there were some 500 members of Al-Qaeda left. The captured or killed members of the Al-Qaeda leadership, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of September 11th attacks, and Mohammed al-Qahtani, who was the real suspected 20th hijacker. They also acquired Al-Qaeda computers containing other plans to attack America, and according to a retired CIA chief, we've killed or captured one or two terrorists a day for 5 years all over the world. You know, in all seriousness, you know, good for them. It's not a fair argument to say that the Battle of Afghanistan was not effective in capturing and damaging Al-Qaeda and its leadership. But we also have to realize that the mission is not accomplished. In reality, this administration cut and run from its responsibilities in Afghanistan. We never fully did all we could to destroy Al-Qaeda, and we withdrew too early. As of today, Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, are still at large. The Taliban has grown back in power because we didn't finish our job. And that was verified just this week by the president of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf, in this clip, which I'm about to play.
The president, General Pervez Musharraf, is warning the Taliban has gotten so strong in Afghanistan it now poses a larger threat than Al-Qaeda.
The center of gravity of terrorism has shifted from Al-Qaeda to Taliban. This is a new element which has emerged, a more dangerous element because it has roots in the people. Al-Qaeda did not have roots in the people. So Taliban are more organized, they have roots in the people.
So as we heard from just this clip, the Taliban is back, and as for UBL, or Osama bin Laden, forgive me, I'm looking at my outline as I'm doing this, how do we allow him and Zawahiri to still be out there? And we know they're out there because they're putting out videotapes. And if you happen to have caught some of the most recent videotape that they released, it wasn't scratchy or grainy. The most recent tape was about a 91-minute long documentary-style message that used green screen technology and English subtitles. That means these people are still well-financed. They're not just out there getting their message across. They're out there using their message with some of the best technology that the media can get you. And yet we can't find them. In fact, I'm pretty sure if you watch that tape long enough, you'd probably see that John 3:16 guy. So, even though we like to believe, or in some aspects, people like to believe that Osama bin Laden has been marginalized, it hasn't been by our full efforts in Afghanistan. It's mostly been by perception alone. And if you don't believe me, listen to this clip by a Fox News expert.
Important. I don't really see the capture and death of bin Laden as nearly as important as the destruction of his infrastructure, his inability to attack the United States. Frankly, if we captured him, I don't know what we'd do with him.
You know, I wasn't sure if I heard that right the first time, but they wouldn't know what to do if they had caught or captured Osama bin Laden. Did I hear that right? I'm not exactly sure what we'd do with him. What is this guy an expert at? Is he just an expert at being an expert on TV? You know, I'm no expert, but here's a good idea. Bring him to justice. This man is responsible for the murders of nearly 3,000 people on September 11th. He's responsible for the deaths of Navy personnel aboard the USS Cole. And he's responsible for the bombings in Africa of our United States embassies. But it's not hard to understand the train of thought that's coming from these people. It's easy to follow this train since it left the roundhouse of George W. Bush. You remember in 2001, all the talk was, we'd find this guy dead or alive. We were going to smoke them out. But since then, and this is actually what happened in March of 2002, not even 6 months later, after the beginning of the Battle of Afghanistan, here's what the president said, and this is from the White House's own transcript of a press conference. This is the president. Terror is bigger than one person, and he's a person who's now been marginalized. His network, his host government's been destroyed. He's the ultimate parasite who found weakness, exploited it, and met his match. I'm going to skip a little bit here. So, I don't know where he is. You know, I just don't spend that much time on him. Our president went from dead or alive, smoke him out, to I just don't spend that much time on him. This is a man who was responsible for one of the worst attacks on American soil. And I just don't spend that much time on him. You know, I've after reading that and reading other articles and listening to people like that Fox expert, when they say he's been marginalized, what they're really trying to say is that he's become unimportant. And some people have argued, and I don't mean to use the some people because it sounds like I'm saying some say, but they're trying to make it sound like he's nothing more than a symbol. Now, George Carlin once said that symbols should be left for the symbol-minded. And I agree, Osama bin Laden is a symbol. But he's something more than that. He's hope. He's hope to the people of that region. He represents the ultimate leadership. To give you an idea, this is from a story called Lost at Tora Bora from the New York Times. At a meeting in November of 2001, Osama bin Laden went to Jalalabad to give a speech at the Islamic Studies Center. He did this while the sounds of bombing occurred outside. After his speech, he went through the room giving out envelopes of money to the leaders of the chieftains there. He's revered as a hero. Now, I wish I could find the site. I spent time trying to find it, so if anybody can find any information like this to solidify this, I would appreciate it. Send it to me at david@indirectdemocracy.com. But I remember a news story after the attacks of 9/11 that reported that not only were there t-shirts of the man the people wear, but he was so popular, and this is if my memory is correct, he even graces a type of sweet or candy bar there. You know, in all of reality, how do you get people to hate a t-shirt? Except for maybe some really bad t-shirts, but even then, how do you get them to hate a candy bar? I mean, how can anyone really effectively argue that this man is irrelevant? That Osama bin Laden is irrelevant. But we have to look at this. Maybe that's how they've always wanted it to be, because since the beginning, how serious were our efforts? I mean, really, honestly, like I said, we bombed the crap out of Afghanistan, but we only provided 20,000 plus troops. As of December 2005, there were approximately 19,000 troops, and they were about to pull out 3,000 more for this year. So here we are, fighting in the area that was the first central front. This was the theater. If we were going to take the fight to anybody, it was going to be right there. Afghanistan was the place where we took the fight. But we have begun to, we've pulled forces out of Afghanistan. And to give you a sense of perspective, this is a perspective that came from Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, so you can either take it from that point that it was from Fahrenheit 9/11 or take it as what it is. For that sense of perspective, there are over 30,000 police officers in New York City. And currently, there's not even 19,000 troops in Afghanistan. 19,000 troops to cover an entire country, to capture one of the most wanted men in the world. And there are more police officers in New York City to do their job. In the Battle of Tora Bora, which this has now become the heart of what I need to talk to you about, CNN reported in its specials, The Footsteps of Bin Laden, that there were only 53 members of the United States Special Forces there. Another news site has it listed at 36, and I'll have those sites up at the research links to indirectdemocracy.com. So if we look at this, 36 to 53 Americans were involved in the Battle of Tora Bora, which was the last known place that we ever actually surrounded or had Osama bin Laden within our grasp. And once again, this is for perspective. That's the size of the amount of players that will start for the Pittsburgh Steelers. By the way, go Steelers. We relied on the Northern Alliance and other military forces to lead the Battle of Tora Bora. According to the same New York Times article, the United States approached forces in Afghanistan, including those led by a man named, or at least one time led by a man named Yunis Khalis. And this is the man who at one time fought alongside Osama bin Laden. We tried to join forces with the man who once called Osama bin Laden the perfect Islamic youth. According to the same article, we followed Afghani forces, or I apologize, not followed, we allowed Afghani forces to mark the targets and give instructions to our U.S. Air Force on where to drop its ordnances. This is just me, but when did they become experts? When did we allow outside forces to direct where it was to drop military bombs, sprays a place with as many bullets as could cover a football field in seconds? Why did we allow this? If we look at this same article called Loss of Tora Bora, these forces were holding negotiations and secret talks with Al-Qaeda, which continued for hours. And we allowed them to control how our American forces were used? In addition, let's see, when a request was made to get additional troops to get there, and this was made by Brigadier General James N. Mattis, the commander of some 4,000 Marines. Okay, Mattis, along with... I apologize for this. Let's see. Mattis, along with another officer with whom the reporter spoke, was convinced that with these numbers, his 4,000 Marines, he could have surrounded and sealed off bin Laden's lair, as well as deployed troops to the most sensitive portions of the largely unpatrolled border with Pakistan. He argued strongly that he should be permitted to proceed to the Tora Bora Caves, but the general was turned down. An American intelligence official told me that the Bush administration, later concluded that the refusal of CENTCOM to dispatch the Marines, along with their failure to commit U.S. ground forces to Afghanistan, generally was the gravest error of the war. And to add to it, it was worse still that the United States, at least our military command, acted as if Tora Bora didn't matter. According to General Tommy Franks, well, gosh, you know, bin Laden got away. I have yet to see anything that proves bin Laden or whomever was there. That's not to say they weren't, but I've not seen any proof that they were there. This is in direct contradiction, and this is from a news article called CIA Commander, U.S. Let Bin Laden Slip Away. Let's see. The CIA field commander for the agency's jawbreaker team at Tora Bora, Gary Bernson, says he and other U.S. commanders did know that bin Laden was among the hundreds of fleeing Qaeda and Taliban members. Bernson said he had definitive intelligence that bin Laden was holed up at Tora Bora. In his book titled Jawbreaker, the decorated CIA officer criticizes Donald Rumsfeld's Defense Department for not providing enough support to the CIA and the Pentagon's own special forces teams in the final hours of Tora Bora. So they let him get away, and they let him escape into Pakistan. And if you've been following the news recently, Pakistan recently tried to cut a deal. And here's what the deal stated. Pakistan Major General Shaukat Sultan Khan as saying bin Laden would not be taken into custody under the deal as long as one is being like a peaceful citizen. White House officials could not immediately confirm the reports, but doubted Pakistan would give bin Laden free rein. Either way, most intelligence sources believe that bin Laden is within Pakistan, and just the idea that this country, which is supposed to be our ally in this war against terror, allows him to be there and would cut even the slightest deal is just stunning. Because we've allowed it. We allowed it to happen. We allowed him to get away. We've allowed the Taliban to get back in power. Bin Laden and the main leadership are still free. And our government goes around compares this fight, this battle, to that of World War II. Now, I wish I had thought of this first, but this is a quote from Ed Schultz, and I don't have the clip. But to paraphrase him, if this was World War II, do you think that for a second that FDR, a Democrat, would not have moved heaven and earth to capture Bin Laden? He wouldn't have stopped. You remember FDR. In World War II, he pledged to win an unconditional surrender. And that's what he did. And that's what we have not done. Dead or alive, smoke him out became, I just don't think about him. And that is not unconditional surrender. That is not victory. And it shouldn't be surprising from a group of people who just don't know how to even define what victory is. If this is really, honestly, the ultimate battle for our civilization, we have really understaffed our fight. Now, this is either because it's being done, and I apologize for the use of this, but it's either because it's being done half-assed, or this battle is not really the priority of our government, despite its claims. We have to focus this battle on Al-Qaeda and the people that fund it. We have to capture Bin Laden. We can't do this by outsourcing the fight. We can't do this by firing Arabic linguists to translate intelligence materials because they're gay. We can't do this by cut and running from Afghanistan because that's where the real fight is. That's where the right war began. We need to regain Afghanistan from the Taliban because NATO forces are suffering from our negligence. And this is also recently. You have to take out Taliban forces with an armed predator drone when the opportunity presents itself. And lastly, you don't do this by shutting down the CIA task force whose sole mission was to find Osama bin Laden. Now, I'm not saying that we can win the war on terror. You can't win a war against an idea or a belief. But we can bring to justice the man who killed 3,000 Americans. We did it in 1993 when we captured, tried, and sentenced to life the men that bombed the World Trade Center, including Ramzi Youssef. See, we have to do this. That, Mr. Fox expert, is what you do with him. Well, we have a new word. We have a new sponsor. And actually, I think this might be helpful to our president and to Osama. So, let's see. Here we go.
Are you struggling to find that special someone?
I just didn't know where to turn.
I really want to find someone that gets me.
I need a website that puts real knowledge to work.
Hi. Are you the overprivileged son of a wealthy family? Well, the people who brought you eHarmony, bringing singles together all over the world, introduce its newest site to help you reconnect with that special someone you just can't catch. Ego.com. At Ego, we will help you find your megalomaniacal soulmate.
I keep telling people I'm trying to find him.
He just doesn't know what games to look in. Ego utilizes the best in intelligence, personality traits, and on-the-ground forces to bring together your perfect match for global domination. Didn't you get my mixtapes?
Maybe he'll notice those flashy alert colors I'm sporting.
Apply now and your first 6 months of goodwill are free. After that, you will pay a little bit in your popularity, but nothing a little fear and others won't stop.
So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on.
I am a 6'4" Saudi with a dialysis machine. How can he not catch me? Ego. We will bring you together. Not valid with any offer or plan suggested by Halliburton.
You know, if anybody can bring those two crazy kids together, maybe that website can. Well, we're going to end off this podcast with giving out our What a Weenie Award. Initially, I was going to name this week's weenie as our president, George Bush, for his politicized speech he gave to the nation on the 5th anniversary of 9/11. To use his time to address the nation over what is still a heart and soul-wrenching event that united us all as Americans, and for moments seared our gaze on a monster that still walks free, only to have the president turn it into a referendum on Iraq creates a certain taste of bile in my mouth. I was going to try to say something, but realized someone said it better for me. If anybody heard Keith Olbermann's special commentary on September 11th, I suggest you listen to this 8-plus minutes of impassioned anger and heartache. It's what really needed to be said. It's what the president should have talked about doing since 9/11. There will be a link to this at the research page for Indirect Democracy. And bravo to you, Mr. Olbermann. I had to stop myself lest I stand in the footsteps of a giant. But here is this week's weenie. This one actually goes to the Democratic leadership for whining about the president's speech. To go out after the fact and act so surprised about the president politicizing a day of national mourning is a lot like saying, you know, when the sun came out, I didn't think it was going to be that bright, or, you know, I really like Halloween, but I didn't know people were going to dress up and get free candy. Of course he was going to talk about Iraq. Of course he was going to include links between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. I mean, he was going to do this even though it's been conclusively proved and admitted by our own president that Iraq and Saddam Hussein had nothing to do, well, but at least the link for Saddam Hussein, that he had nothing to do with September 11th. Of course he was going to talk about a safer world that's not safe. You know, I do this podcast once a week, so maybe I sound like a bit of a weenie for talking about this now. But, Democratic leadership, you're the ones in power. Now, I'm doing this with the quotation marks with my fingers for power. One key reason why people don't see your party as having gravitas or a sense of vision is that you react to what others do too often. We all knew on last Friday he was going to give a speech from the Oval Office on September 11th. You should have been out there on Sunday morning, blast what was a given. He gave you a freebie, and you did nothing. You had every opportunity to blast what this administration doesn't know. They don't know how to define victory. They don't know how to plan an exit strategy. They don't know what happened to non-existent weapons of mass destruction. They don't know why the insurgency has been this strong or lasted as long as it has. They don't know where $9 billion missing dollars in Iraq went to. They don't know how to anticipate planes being used as weapons. They don't know how to anticipate the breach of levees in a Category 4 hurricane and the destruction that would follow. They don't know that pushing for early elections in Palestine would lead to a Hamas-led government. They don't know how to capture Osama bin Laden. They don't know why the price of gas is so high. They don't know how to explain anything outside of a bumper sticker slogan to explain their positions. Mission accomplished. Cut and run. Plan for victory. Adapt to win. Islamofascism. They just don't know. And now is not the time for people who don't know. Democrats, it's time to tell the American people what you know. Share it with us all before the other side says it first. First impressions matter. And lately, this party settles for sloppy seconds. There's too much at stake to settle for scraps. There are real problems that have to be addressed and fixed. Stand up with your plan now. Waiting for the other guys would cost you in 2002 and 2004. To quote from Major Victory from Who Wants to Be a Superhero, Democratic Party, be a winner, not a wiener. Well, that's going to be it for this particular podcast of Indirect Democracy. Before I end the show, I would be remiss without thanking the guys from Megaphone, Matt Bloodwell, and all of them for allowing me the use of their song Not Your Enemy from the album For Crying Out Loud. Let's see, you can get their music at www.megaphonemusic.net or at their website, at their MySpace website at www.myspace.com/megaphone. Until then, thank you for listening, take care of yourselves, and I will see you next week. I'm not a spy. God, tomorrow's Friday.